We're working overtime on the seduction line. It's the Morning Shift Sports Radio, 1990 AM. Triple in for Tiffany on this Friday.
Pop your collars and drop your dollars. Rob Tribble today.
Oh, Mr. Young Squid with management boy over there. You're kind of brooding and disagreeable today. What's wrong with you?
Young Squid is his name.
You wake up on the wrong side of the slab? What's going on?
What is
this? I can't with you today. No, I'm in a great mood, actually.
I can tell.
Other than having to be surrounded by an offensive lineman and a relief pitcher, I'm great.
I was a spot starter.
Think of how we feel.
A spot starter? Oh, you're the best, Rob.
Yeah. Spot starter and a swing tackle.
It's Friday, man. Mike and I have both been affected by road work coming in, and I have nothing wrong. I don't hold grudges against any of the road work. I understand. I appreciate the fact that it's getting done, but I don't know. It's just that I had to go north today to go south.
Sounds like Atlanta.
Yeah. Because my exit was – And I guess I did get a warning, but I didn't get a warning until I was at the exit. The exit was closed, the ramp, get on south. So I had to go up 575, one exit, which is luckily only literally like half a mile, maybe three quarters of a mile, to come back down south. So it took an extra couple minutes. But I'm sitting there at dinner last night after we played a little golf, and the World Series starts tonight, Rob. And my neighbor is a diehard Yankees fan. Now, when I say diehard, he doesn't watch every game, but he's a Yankees fan.
And where's he from, Columbus?
No, he's from Jersey.
Okay.
He was born in up there, and then he moved to Orlando.
You're the Cowboys of Major League Baseball, the bandwagoners.
Well, there are a lot of them. And then, so me and my other neighbor were talking, and I'm sitting next to the guy that's a Yankees fan. I forgot. My other neighbor's a Braves fan. And we're talking about how bad we hate the Yankees and we're going to pull for the Dodgers to win the World Series. And I look over and I go, hey, who's in the World Series? He's like, dude, I know. He's like, trust me, that's what we're doing tonight. We're watching the World Series. And I felt kind of bad because he pulled for the Braves in 21 when the Braves were in it.
Yeah.
He sat there and watched every game with us. As soon as the World Series was over, came over and we drank some Wellers and we celebrated. And I just kind of felt bad that I'm like, yeah, I hate the Yankees. I hope they lose. And I was kind of conflicted for a moment. Am I the a-hole that I don't pull for his team when he pulled for mine?
No, because I don't like the Yankees either. But when I was a kid, this series would have meant everything.
Yeah.
It is so glamorous and iconic. And as a Braves fan, last time they played was 1981. As a Braves fan, 1981, I was locked in because the Braves were so terrible. And I was like, wow, this is so glamorous. I wish I could never conceive of the notion of the Braves even getting there, being allowed behind that velvet rope of elite baseball teams. Of course, they won the division next year under Joe Torre. But now I'm like, I'll peek at it. If I see Ohtani in the on-deck circle, I'll tune in to see that at bat. You know,
This World Series to me highlights everything I hate about most sports business models. And I've talked about it a number of times on here. The NFL is the best product in the world because it's the fairest.
Yeah.
Right? You just don't have that in most other sporting leagues throughout the world. You don't have the hard salary cap and everything else that comes along with that. And yet, I hate seeing big market teams buy their way into these kind of situations. Now, you still have to go out and perform, and you still have to go out and stay healthy. But it's frustrating for me. You know, I prefer the way the Braves do it or some of the other smaller market teams.
Well, you know, when the Yankees were winning all those titles in, what, the 40s, 50s, 60s, the rest of Major League Baseball was like their bona fide minor league system.
Yeah.
They just go out and take anyone they want. Well, that explains the dominance.
I still like that, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not that far off. They just have more competition in that realm from teams like the Dodgers and the Mets sometimes and the Padres and other teams that try to go out and pay these exorbitant contracts that – I mean, Shohei Ohtani's contract's what, $700 million or whatever? I mean, who else is going to be able to pay that?
Can launch his own space program.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Man, it's going to be a beautiful weekend, gentlemen. We got the One Music Fest going on over there and right over there off North Avenue. What is that? What, Cardi B, Earth, Wind, and Fire. I think there's only like three of those original guys left, though. We got Method Man. I'm going to the Benteen Park Festival tomorrow over there near Grant Park. Just a regular fall festival, but they have professional wrestling, minor league wrestling.
Kidding.
Yeah.
That's the best.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic. It's so absurd and hilarious.
Did you guys, The other day, Bo, you might have seen it. I retweeted a video on Twitter where I think it was Jake the Snake and Macho Man, and the snake bites him in the ring back in like 91. Like, what a classic moment.
Yeah, I didn't see your tweet, but I do remember that video. Yeah. And it's because I'm not a snake, I'm not fans of snakes.
Yeah, no, yeah, bro.
And so it used to freak me out that he would let Damien out and let it crawl all over his victims. I say his victims, but like his opponents after he beat them. But I've never been more freaked out in my entire life than when I was a kid and I watched the Ultimate Warrior go into the funeral parlor and Paul Bearer interview, and the Undertaker attacks him from behind and locked him in a casket.
That was real fear.
And they're like, man, they're trying to pry the casket open, and I mean, like, freaked me out. And they finally get it open, and the casket's ripped up with claw marks, and the Ultimate Warrior was like kind of passed. I mean, I tell you, dude, that nothing freaked me out in pro wrestling more than
wrestling,
that moment,
baby. There was nothing better, man. Nothing
the most
better.
Impressive thing about the Ultimate Warrior, that physique was all natural. It was all natural. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Rest in peace.
That was he wasn't a very well-liked guy in the locker room.
I can see that. Well, the roid rage and the acne.
A lot of it apparently had to do with, because I don't watch it anymore.
I don't either.
But what I will do is I'll watch every bleeping documentary about the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s.
I don't want to watch the documentaries.
I do. I love it. I love hearing the inside stuff about.
Well, they're all dead.
Well, not all of them. Hold on, not all of them.
You know what I mean.
But yeah, no, a lot of guys in that era did pass away, but they said he just wouldn't play ball. He wasn't a very professional guy. He went in there and had like 90-second matches, and a lot of them didn't like him because he wasn't one of them. He was just a bodybuiler that wrestled. But anyways, Rams Vikings last night, entertaining game.
Uh-oh. The Vikings panicking. They've lost two in a row. No, they haven't. They beat the Lions. Wait a minute. They lost to the Lions. Yeah, they've lost two in a row.
And that's what happens in those short weeks. Look, they've been in both game last night. The Rams were at full strength for the first time.
Yeah, Cooper Kupp, Puka Nacua back.
Dude, Puka, he just catches everything.
He's a dog.
Got me 18 points last night.
The wide receiver display last night was insane. Yep. Justin Jefferson goes over 100 last night as well.
See that catch he made on the sideline?
Yeah. I mean, the ability of Puka to catch a ball in stride, in traffic, and never break stride and never slow down, never loses momentum is insane. And Matthew Stafford's ability to put it right on his chest is equally as insane. When you look at some of those little quick slants and little seams he runs, it's nuts, dude. It's crazy. He looks like he's going to get his head taken off at any minute, and he's just like, no, I'm just going to keep running full speed.
He kind of slithers free for another 2-3 yards, man. And the Vikings, you feel like that's the most complete team in the NFL? I mean, what do they have, like 24 sacks, 11 interceptions, or top of all the statistical categories as far as that goes? But
yeah, but
it just shows you.
That interception that Stafford threw last night, I looked at Mike and I said, hold on, was there pressure here? Let's go rewatch this. No. He just overthrows a guy. I'm like, we never get just an overthrown interception. Like, I feel like we never get the easy play that works out in our favor. But the Puka Nacua is living proof that human error is alive and well in the NFL draft. He made it to the fifth round. It's just incredible. Then again, though, Drake London is living proof that, you know what? Sometimes they know what they're doing. Bijan Robinson, because Drake, don't look now, but shade under 500 yards and less than 50 catches.
All right, Mike, you asked a question about Sunday.
I did, man.
What was that question?
Which team is under more pressure to win on Sunday? Which one is it?
We're gonna dive into that and do all the nuance and all the things coming up next. It's a Falcons Friday, a Fair or Foul Friday on the Morning Shift Sports Radio, 92.9 The Game. Welcome back to the Morning Shift, Triple M for Tiffany Sports Radio, 92.9 The Game. Atlanta United in Miami tonight. Best of three aggregate thing in the playoffs as far as that goes. Improbable victory in Montreal and just getting into the playoffs altogether for Atlanta United. But, well, the planets all met last weekend, enabled them to get that date up there in Montreal. World Series Game 1, East Coast, West Coast. South got nothing to say in the World Series. College football this weekend, noon tomorrow in Blacksburg, Virginia Tech, Georgia Tech. Maybe Georgia Tech can embrace the notion of playing solid special teams. We shall see. Georgia off, so they get ready to take on Florida. You were exhilarated after that Kentucky victory, right? It's like anything you can get at this juncture.
you almost got me to say some words that I'm not supposed to say.
Oh, dear.
According to the FCC. But, yeah, I think it was Mike Conte. We were before the Falcons game Sunday. I said, this is the point. This is where I'm at in life, where a Kentucky win gets me excited. But, yeah, I mean, you know, when your team shows up and they do things differently than they've been doing, it's fun to see. It's kind of, with all due respect, I think that's kind of what we've seen the last, what, month with Atlanta United? Or at least three games where they've done, you know, they kept themselves around, and then all of a sudden they hit a little burst where they're all of a sudden playing above their heads, it feels like. Where they're doing the things they didn't do all year, like score timely goals and, you know, make timely saves and be clutch. And that's kind of what I saw from Florida against Kentucky. The defense made stops. They tackled well. They turned the ball over. And the offense capitalized on it. So it was just fun to see. And, you know, you never know. That's what sports is, unpredictable, Rob.
It is.
Like you.
I am. I'm a wild card to that.
I love that about you, actually.
All right, Mr. Johnson, you asked the notion which team is under more pressure. 4-3 Falcons visiting 4-3 Tampa Bay, both teams with three losses, both teams with one NFC loss and two AFC losses, so they're basically identical as far as all tie-breaking scenarios.
Except for
the head-to-head.
That's right, in the division.
Yeah,
the division.
And I think that's an important part of this conversation, right, and thinking about it kind of on the way in this morning, you know, kind of weighing where the Falcons are at, because I think that this is a critical game. I think it's a critical game for both teams. I do look at Tampa and probably think they are under a little more pressure. I think Atlanta's under a pressure from the fan base to kind of get right in a couple of categories, right? You want to see offensive efficiency. You want to see the third down, you know, numbers continue to climb. You want to see your ability to defend the pass on all levels continue to kind of evolve, your ability to defend the run. Tampa, when you look at it and coming off losing their two biggest stars, and also the fact that Atlanta already has the tiebreaker against them, you feel like you have to get this one at home, I think, if you're Tampa Bay and you have eyes at all on winning the division.
And Tampa Bay's got to go to Kansas City next week.
Yes. And here's the thing. I'll say this. If Tampa wins, and I have to pull back up the schedule for me, I remember thinking it yesterday. If Tampa were to win, it's almost like you don't even care what happens the next couple of weeks if you're a Tampa fan, because you got a bye week coming up. You're going to play Kansas City, but it's like, you know, it is what it is. And then they're down the stretch after their bye week. It's not awful for them. They have a couple of opportunities out there with the way their schedule kind of lines up at the back end. So, but I do think that there is a lot weighing on this game for Tampa. I think they're going to throw everything they have at this game, and I think unfortunately for them, they are missing their two biggest stars, and that's going to be an uphill climb.
How many times have you seen, especially if you're a Falcons fan, you go play a team, they're hobbled, they're missing two or three of their biggest stars per se. And somehow through hook or crook, something weird happens, and that team that's hobbled ends up beating the Falcons.
Oh, we're star makers. The Atlanta Falcons have been star makers, dude. There's no doubt about it. Am I wrong about that?
I think
star makers.
I would love to go sit in another city for maybe a season and see how fans feel about their teams, because I feel like the Braves are star makers. Every time the Braves play a new pitcher,
that's right.
They face a new pitcher. The guy looks like Fernando Valenzuela against them. Like, he's like, you've never heard of the guy, and all of a sudden he's throwing, you know, eight scoreless in his first outing. And you're like, what the hell is going on here? With the way the game was, where 66 total points was scored in the last outing, you went into overtime. The offense is 500 yards of offense from 500 yards of passing from Kirk Cousins. And, you know, Baker Mayfield was a pedestrian, 19 of 24 for 180 yards and three touchdowns. Do you feel like this game might be a slow grind?
Oh, yeah.
Like the over-under for this game, I was just looking at these over-unders, and there's some crazy over-unders.
Is it 41 or something like that?
45.5.
Mm.
I almost want to take the under, because I think, you know what?
Yeah, what goes there's, up must come down.
There's no way that they just have a dial-a-score game again, right?
No. But with their two best receivers out, and Tampa Bay's discovered their running game.
Yeah, you know? and we have too as of late. We've ran the ball well as of late too.
Two and a half hour game on Sunday.
I'm just so curious, to your point, what their plan is for Vita Vea, because he did control Ryan Neusel, and with Ryan Neusel hobbled and there are questions around him, there's got to be a game plan for how you want to attack that. I can't imagine
run away from him.
Well, and that's the thing. I think usually wide zone, which we are known for, is kind of meant to attack guys like Vita Vea. It's like, well, you can't cover sideline to sideline. And then he kind of disrupted everything we were trying to do with that last time out. So I can't imagine they go back in with the same game plan and say, Ryan, you just got to play better. You know what I mean? Like, that's probably not a good idea. So I did notice that Baltimore, not specifically last week, Baltimore started to implement some of their Wham-style plays where you kind of crack back on interior defensive linemen with, like, your H-back, like a Charlie Warner. I think that would be kind of cool to see. I don't know that we do any of that or even have that in the game plan or the system, period. But that's kind of how you could go about doing it. But it just – the things that you usually do to get dominant defensive linemen – off kilter like that, we don't do a ton of. And I'm talking about, you know, running back screens and draws and things like that. It's just seldom sprinkled in.
And I think, to me, that's my number one key offensively, is figure out how to block 50. That is the, if you ask me what's the number one thing we got to do on offense, get a hat on 50. Don't let him change the game, because guess what? He got a sack last time. I know it was a weird thing where Bijan somehow got maxed up on him. But, and it's not supposed to happen, but to me, he's the difference maker, because he opens everything up for guys like Levante David and KJ Britt and Yaya Diaby, like, you know, Tyron Shoyinka. Like, it is all about how you handle Vita Vea and Kalijah Kancey up front, and then it completely opens everything up for those guys. So get a hat on him. That's my number one thing to do. And if I was on... If you ask me defensively, what do you got to do? Got to slow down that three-headed monster.
Imagine Bijan Robinson being confronted with the notion of Vita Vea. It's like, good
oh,
Lord.
He was confronted with it. Yeah. He opted out, which I don't blame him. It didn't sound like Raheem Morris blamed him either. It was like just one of those things we've kind of covered. It's like you have rules built in, and the defense's job is to build in a situation where they can take advantage of your rules. You know what I mean? And kind of vice versa. It's like, well, we know they're going to – looks like when they get A-gap pressure, they'll just squeeze down right there. Let's see if we can put Vita Vea in that B-gap. Oh, my God. Bijan's like, no, thanks. I'm good. Just go ahead and hit Kirk. You're good.
And it was kind of like when, you know, we were talking about wrestling earlier. It's kind of like when The Undertaker threw Mankind off the Hell in a Cell. That's what it looked like when Vita Vea came at Bijan Robinson. It was just like, oh,
Bijan
God.
Was like, nah,
there's carnage.
Business decision. Nobody blamed him, man. That's a guy that weighs twice as much as you do.
What about Buccaneers defense? Are you talking about issues with Falcons? I mean, the Ravens lit them up for, what, 508 yards? How many yards the Falcons have in that overtime game? 509 by Kirk, so it's got to be approaching 600 yards, too.
Yeah, you had 70-something on the ground. Yep. No, look, they got – they haven't – they're as good as they – they're, like, in the top 10 in every number offensively that matters.
Yeah.
Scoring, you know, rushing production, passing production, third downs. You flip it over and – they're at the bottom half of the league in every defensive category. They're allowing 132 yards on the ground, over 250 through the air. They're not getting teams off the field on third down. Their red zone defense is actually middle of the pack.
Well, they play the exact same style that we always talk about. A lot of teams in the NFL are playing.
Yeah, basically, bend, don't break.
We'll let you get to the red zone. Sure. You can just walk to the red zone pretty much, but –
and that's when we clamp down inside the 20. Yep.
Now they are plus one in the turnover, so they're doing well there. They're causing fumbles, and they're picking the ball off. But honestly, we are too. I mean, we're doing an okay job. We're not the best, but we've got five interceptions already this year. We couldn't say that last year.
Or no.
Well, maybe other than Jesse Bates.
Maybe we'll get Bad Baker again this week. Maybe 2 weeks in a row of Bad Baker, because Bad Baker turned the ball over last week against the Ravens.
Rob had the stat earlier. His first five games, two interceptions.
Yeah.
His last two?
Was it?
Five.
Five, yeah.
So he's in this pressing turn the ball over mode.
Yeah, here's your red zone stat for Tampa. 41.5% of the drives against Tampa, against their defense, have gone to the red zone. That's the third worst mark in the league behind the Panthers and the Cardinals. So you're basically, it's like, yeah, cool, man. Like, you're going to throw underneath. You're not going to be as deep, but you're probably going to make it to the red zone if you don't break a tackle and go the distance. And then we'll try to stop you when we get down there.
How concerned are you with the Ryan Neusel situation? How much of a step down you got to deal with Vita Vea right there in front of you, whoever's snapping the ball?
I don't think I'd be terribly concerned if it wasn't for the fact that he already struggled with Vita Vea.
Yep.
He struggled with him. I mean, in the run game, you go back and look, he got ragdolled a couple times. And that's a tough block, man, and he's already kind of an undersized guy. Strong,
what is,
you know.
What is Vita Vea, 350?
Yeah.
Well, that's what he's listed at.
Right. You know.
Yeah, you know, but I'd have coaches that would say he's a biscuit short of 400. Yeah. And he's already struggled, so that's what worries me. If it was just simply Ryan Neusel, you know, he's banged up a little bit, you got a tough defensive lineman front, I'd be go, it is what it is. You know, go out there and play ball. But what I saw last time, they got to have a game plan for that, man.
All right, coming up, oh, by the way, this hour brought to you by Morgan & Morgan, America's largest injury law firm. All right, coming up next, Week 9 college football. First place in the SEC on the line, and it doesn't involve either Georgia or Alabama. What planet are we on? What dimension are we existing in? Good Lord! It's coming up next in the morning shift, Sports Radio 1990 Game. Fourth Saturday in October. A huge one in the SEC, and it's not involving either Alabama or Georgia. Texas A&M hosting LSU. Texas A&M a 2.5-point favorite at home. And, gentlemen, this is a fascinating matchup. LSU has shown they can win shootouts or they can win close games. Texas A&M's offensive line, they're like one of the best offensive lines in the country. They're not letting opposing teams get to their quarterback. Something's got to give tomorrow. LSU can be very disruptive, too. As far as defensively speaking, this is going to be – that vibe at Kyle Field tomorrow night is going to be something. I would love to go to a game there.
Oh, I would too. Texas A&M is very good up front on defense too.
Yeah.
They've got a couple of guys coming off the edge that can get after you. And Nussmeier, he'll throw it to you. So, you know, I just wonder if they can get enough pressure early, Mike, and maybe make him uncomfortable and get him throwing – if he can throw the ball to you a couple of times, if you're A&M, you might be set up to kind of really hammer down on them.
Yeah, you are. And honestly, both of these teams are very, very good, but have a little bit of inconsistent quarterback play. And Garrett Nussmeier he's been extremely good. Don't get me wrong. His ability to kind of throw it downfield and hit some of the longer plays and make explosives. But you're right. I mean, we talked about it yesterday. He's a little bit of like last year's Sam Howell for the Commanders, where it's like, dude, I'm going to get 400, but I'm going to give you one. Like, I'm going to give you one over the middle. Connor Wegman kind of the same way. Some weeks, Connor Wegman for Texas A&M looks like a Heisman candidate. And other weeks, it's like he just completely goes away and plays extremely inconsistently and makes some bad decisions. So this is kind of a show-me game. Like, if you want to prove that you're a top-five caliber team after, you know, losses earlier in the year that both of these teams sustained out of conference, then show me, right? Show me that you've kind of improved as a team over the last few weeks and that you're ready to make your appearance in the SEC title game.
LSU's got to prove they can run the ball. They haven't been really good in short yardage situations either running the ball. I don't mean they can't, but that certainly hasn't emerged yet.
It's just so weird to me, the brand of LSU. The brand that LSU has been under Brian Kelly is so foreign, where they're throwing, it's like, we're going to score 40 points. I don't know how much we're going to run the ball, you know, if it's not the quarterback. The running backs seem like the last couple of years are kind of secondary, and we're also going to have a defense that's going to give up 40. Like, it just, like, when did that happen at LSU, man? Like, it just seems like that has completely flip-flopped from what it was 10 years ago when you had Leonard Fournette and he was going to run it down your throat and they were going to hold you to like 6 points.
Yeah. Well, it's the whole, I mean, everybody does it now. Like the whole conference, the whole SEC plays defense and no one else does thing is kind of gone by the wayside.
Yeah, it has.
Other than Georgia and Alabama to a lesser extent these days and still at times, nobody plays defense really in the SEC. You go to the Big Ten, and I'm not a Big Ten guy, you know that, but they play a lot more. Their defenses have been better. You look at Iowa last year. Iowa had one of the best defenses in the country. And
They had to,
but it wasn't just because they played in the Big Ten, though. They had a good Penn State's got a pretty good defense this year. But it's just adapting to you want to blame Lane Kiffin.
So
because when Lane Kiffin went to Alabama, it kind of made that switch where teams started scoring more points. I'm not blaming it
all.
They
were late to the party, though.
I know.
You're talking about Gus Malzahn going to Auburn and like all those other things.
But that's when it kind of transitioned. Florida's the same way. Florida used to be a known – Florida and LSU used to be two of the best defensive teams year in and year out in the SEC and in the country. Neither one of them are anymore.
What was Gus Malzahn's big innovation? Remember, he was that high school coach. They won a bunch of state titles.
Yeah, I mean, it was just – it was.
You know what it was for me? You tell me what you think about this. I feel like he ran Paul Johnson's offense out of the shotgun with a little bit more throwing.
Yeah, I mean, but even then, back then, he wasn't a huge RPO guy until his time at head coach with Nick Marshall. Like, that was when really the RPO kind of thing kind of came out, where Nick would kind of throw it into the flat after running the zone read, you know what I mean?
He'd
throw it out to the wide receiver that was behind the line of scrimmage. The whole downfield RPO thing wasn't really much of his either. He was just an innovator in terms of, I think, to me anyways, north and south running game with guys like Kerryon Johnson. What was that, 6-7 years ago at Auburn? And also ability to kind of throw it vertically. That just – but again – And I'm actually a bigger Gus Malzahn fan than I like to admit. He had some really good dudes running it. You know what I mean? That Auburn team that won in 2010, I don't know that I've ever seen one national championship team posted up by one player more than that team actually did. And they had, don't get me wrong, this is not a shot at Auburn. This is a compliment to Cam Newton and what he was able to do that year in terms of bringing that team back from some of the deficits they were facing, the Iron Bowl being one of them, Clemson being one of them that year. But Gus Malzahn kind of calling the plays and designing all that thing, it was just different back then, man. I remember playing Gus Malzahn when I was in college, and he was at Arkansas, and he had Mitch Mustain was his high school quarterback.
I was about to say, that's the guy who we kind of piggybacked into the college ranks.
Yeah.
Mustain just kind of disappeared
into
security.
We lost to them that year in two overtimes. I think we missed five kicks that would have won the game. Five kicks.
Yeah, you look at and I had to pull it up because I couldn't remember the running back's name that played on that Auburn team. But Michael Dyer,
yeah,
he was phenomenal.
Yeah,
he had a 1,000-yard rusher. You had a two-headed monster, to your point. And you also remember you had some good players on defense as well.
Yeah, especially, that's what I said. This is not me saying anything about the other players on this team.
No, this is
me saying that Cam Newton, literally, it would be like, oh, they really need a big play right here. Stiff arm, roll out.
Yeah.
Juke somebody. Oh, I'm going to outrun you. And it was like, oh, my God.
Well, that the Alabama game was living proof of that.
Yeah.
They were down, 21-0, and Cam put the team on his back and brought him back.
You schedule in front of you? I think they opened with Clemson that year, and I think it was a comeback win against Clemson, and it was something just unbelievable.
They played Clemson in the third game of the year.
Okay.
And they won 27-24. But they did
it
have
was
to,
something
they
insane.
Had to come back in that game though. But you go, Mike, to your point, you go look at a lot. They didn't blow a lot of people out. I mean, they won some close games against Miss State, South Carolina, Clemson, Kentucky. Arkansas was like a 100-something point game.
Yes.
65-43. They beat LSU by 7. I mean, they played a lot of close games. There were a lot of clutch moments.
Speaking of Gus Malzahn, have you guys taken a peek at that line this weekend? Bo, I think you brought it up earlier.
It's weird. It's like a 7-point line.
And UCF's favor, though, right? They're favored in the game against BYU.
Yeah, and BYU's going on the road. Now, UCF has lost the last two games with like a combined 9 points or some crap like that. But that's a team
that got routed by Colorado a few weeks
ago. And I watched Florida handle them. Florida gave them everything, more than they could handle, which was weird to me. But it's at UCF. It's a 3:30 kick. It's not 7. It's 2.5. I think it's moved. I swear it was more.
It didn't go down, but I saw it at 3 yesterday.
So it's 2.5. Dude.
The antennae going off, Rob. Just starting to, I don't know. Just, hey, we got to make our picks coming up at 8 o'clock, man. I'm just telling you, that's a weird one.
Missouri, Alabama. Missouri without their quarterback, though, that's going to be helpful for Alabama. What's the level of freak out in Tuscaloosa now? Kalen DeBoer in over his head. He's not the guy.
I don't know if anybody's there yet as far as Kalen DeBoer.
Because that fan base is so rational.
Well, there's a lot of frustration. Well, college football fans are rational. Let's just leave it there. There's a lot of frustration, I think, with Jalen Milroe. You start looking at his whole body of work, it's just a lot of peaks and valleys, man. A lot of peaks and valleys. And it hasn't bitten you. You know, it could have bit you a couple times last year. It did bite you against Tennessee last week. And so that's the frustration right now. But I don't know that anybody's in fire killing DeBoer mode. Maybe a couple, but I don't think most people are there yet.
This hour brought to you by Morgan & Morgan, America's largest injury law firm. Well, no Chris Godwin for the Buccaneers on Sunday, no Mike Evans, but the Falcons will have to deal with Rashad White, Bucky Irving, and Sean Tucker. That doesn't sound sexy, but wait till you look at the numbers. It's coming up next in the morning shift, Sports Radio 99 The Game.